Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, an interview with playwright Issa Davis. Her new production, Mushroom, is being staged at People's Light. And as Banned Books Week gets underway, we'll speak with school librarian Martha Hickson, a leader in the fight against censorship. But to start, Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner's second term in office would be short-lived if a large number of Pennsylvania state lawmakers have their way. The State House is conducting an impeachment investigation, and a vote just last week to hold Krasner in contempt for refusing to comply with the subpoena passed overwhelmingly. At heart is the city's unrelenting epidemic of gun violence and the perception that Krasner's office is too soft when it comes to prosecution. Krasner vigorously disputes this, but as gun violence continues to grip the city, Philadelphia's district attorney finds himself in an extraordinary position. Although not unique, San Francisco's progressive DA, Chesa Boudin, was recalled by voters earlier this year amid a spike of crimes in that city. Jordan Levy has been reporting on the Krasner story for Billy Penn and joins us now with the latest. Hi, Jordan.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. So let's begin with the initial move to impeach Krasner. It started unofficially in June when three State House Republicans circulated a memo attacking Krasner's policies. Jordan, what was their argument against Krasner's performance as DA?
Their argument is really all-encompassing. The term dereliction of duty comes up time and time again, and they really noted there's a willful refusal, in their view, for Krasner to enforce the laws, that he's not really prosecuting criminals to the fullest extent of the law, and that he's also not showing the proper respect for victims of crimes. Those are really the primary overarching arguments. So if you ask for specific points, it'll be hard to find at some points because they really think across the board he's not doing the job.
Are any of the three Republican lawmakers from Philly?
No, they're not. They're mostly from central PA and then a few in western. And the person, well, not to get ahead of ourselves, but the person chairing the panel to investigate him is from Chester County.
Okay. So the movement picked up steam toward the end of June with the establishment of the panel you just referenced, mm-hmm. the House Select Committee on Restoring Law and Order, correct?
Yep.
Which is bipartisan. What mm-hmm. is the specific job of this committee?
The job of the committee is really to investigate him. The state constitution notes to find any misbehavior in office or infamous crime. And it has to be bipartisan. It's chaired by three Republicans, so they're the party in power, but there are two Democrats on the panel as well.
Two Philadelphia Democrats.
Indeed, Amin Brown and Danilo Burgos, both of Philadelphia, both Democrats. And their job is to not only use the subpoena power they have to look into his policies and his practices, but also to collect testimony, which is something House Republicans have been emphasizing.
Jordan Levy, how has Larry Krasner responded?
Not positively. He thinks it's illegal, and he's said so many times. He's argued so in court. But his message to voters really has been that this would be a violation of your constitutional rights, that it wouldn't respect your right to elect officials to office.
Is it within the state legislature's authority to impeach Philadelphia's district attorney?
Well, as far as we know, yes. I guess pending on the result of a petition he filed in the Commonwealth Court, the answer could be no. But as of right now, everything by the state constitution seems to point towards him being a civil officer of the state, which is the category of impeachable officers.
A quick review of the process. The select committee has appointed a working group, which will investigate mm-hmm. Krasner. So what happens next if the committee determines via the work of this group that there is evidence that impeachment should go forward? What is the next step there?
The working group files a report, a special report, and then they can drop articles of impeachment. Needs to get a majority vote in the House to pass, and then it would go over to the Senate. And to finalize the impeachment, there would need to be a two-thirds majority in the Senate.
Let's talk about the odds of passage, Jordan, for articles of impeachment, before both the State House and Senate. So, again, the State House held a floor vote just last week on whether Krasner should be held in contempt for failing to comply with the subpoena. That vote was overwhelmingly in favor. It included a lot of Democrats. So, again, why are some Democrats seemingly potentially supportive of the impeachment process? Democrats here. And we're talking about a sizable number of them, from Philly.
For sure. 10 is the number, to be exact. Philadelphia House representatives who are Democrats who voted to hold him in contempt. And it's unclear whether they would vote to impeach, but clearly last week they said that they believe they have the institutional authority to investigate him, and his refusal to comply with subpoenas was seen as an infringement of their powers. So that was one of the reasons they signed on. Of course, Krasner has not always been a party favorite. He ran as an outsider and then was not endorsed when he ran as an incumbent. So he's never been a party man, so to speak, even though he has support from plenty of Democrats as well.
Yeah, and to be clear, too, that subpoena involved a case concerning a former Philadelphia police officer, Ryan Pinnell.
Yes, who shot a man named David Jones in the back when Jones was fleeing from him and had dropped his weapon. It's interesting that the Republicans subpoenaed this evidence, especially since Krasner used this case to try and argue that the state's justifiable use of force policy needs to change. So it was a case that garnered a lot of attention because he attempted, which was denied by the state Supreme Court, by the way, last month, to use it to change the state's use of force policy, or at least to get that process in motion.
So if articles of impeachment, which go to the floor for a full House vote, if they pass and then this all goes to the Senate where a trial is held, what are the odds that the state Senate might approve? Two completely different bodies. Mm-hmm. Is there a Democratic contingent within the Senate that might be leaning in this direction?
Well, one of the things is that with the longtime Republican majority in the state Senate, there doesn't need to be too many Democrats to vote against Krasner. It would only need to be 5. Mm-hmm. And an interesting note that I saw Daniel Pearson, who writes for The Inquirer, put on Twitter a few days ago was that there are 2 state senators from Philadelphia who represent districts that voted for Carlos Vega over Krasner in 2021, meaning that if they're going by the will of the voters, odds are they would probably vote against him.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, Jordan Levy, that Krasner has taken some flack regarding his relationship or lack thereof, perhaps, with crime victims. Can you get into that some more for us?
Well, Krasner hasn't eliminated offices or positions that handle and reach out to, confer with, consult victims of crime. But he's a reform prosecutor. He's made that clear for the bulk of his career.
Sure.
And I would say classically, district attorneys often listen to victims' families, and when they're told that they want the people who have done them harm to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, DAs often do not hesitate. Yeah. Krasner, based on his philosophy of prosecution, has hesitated on that front many times. So it's not that he's always not speaking to people, but it's that he doesn't always act by their wishes.
Let's talk briefly about something called the 100 Shooting Review, which has declared gun violence in Philadelphia a public health crisis. What does this have to say about the DA's office and whether it's doing the job to reduce gun violence?
It's a review that happens after 100 shootings takes place in the city. Unfortunately, earlier and earlier it's issued nowadays. But it noted that while arrests for illegal gun possession and recovering guns from crime scenes has risen, shooting arrest rates remain low, and prosecution and conviction rates for illegal gun possessions have been declining since 2015, so before his term, a few years before his term. They also noted that conviction rates in shooting cases, and the distinction between illegal gun possession and shooting is really important here. So while the first one, illegal gun possession, has been declining, convictions and shooting rate cases has gone up slightly in the past 2 years.
Okay.
That being said, I don't think it's by the margins that would really convince anybody that Krasner is super effective on those grounds.
Last year, Police Commissioner Daniel Outlaw said the criminal justice system has become a revolving door for repeat offenders. Jordan, describe the relationship as it stands now between the DA's office and the Philadelphia Police Department.
As with victims of crime, Krasner has also eschewed a lot of the classical approaches to dealing with the police departments. He's been much more willing to prosecute police officers for misconduct based on his past as a defense attorney and dealing with clients who were facing police violence. So there hasn't been the smoothest relationship because of that. And, you know, in the kind of crisis that we're in, I think there's always going to be some degree of finger pointing, especially as arrest rates aren't stellar, just as conviction rates aren't stellar. So when both of those things aren't good, the finger pointing becomes much more, pointed.
Pronounced. So residents of San Francisco voted to recall their DA, Progressive Chasif Boudin, a few months ago. Impeachment aside, can something like a recall happen in Philadelphia?
No, it can't.
There was an effort, back in the 70s to recall Mayor Rizzo.
Petitioners had gotten enough signatures, but then city commissioners who were aligned with Rizzo invalidated enough of them so that an election wouldn't happen. The petitioners argued that to a court who agreed with them, and it was appealed to the state Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court not only agreed with the city commissioners that a lot of the signatures were not collected correctly, but they also noted that they don't think officials, as stated in the Philadelphia Charter, should be able to be recalled without a certain misbehavior or a crime.
Got it. Noteworthy, Jordan, Philadelphia has long lobbied to be able to implement stricter gun laws on the municipal level and has been stymied at every turn by the Republican majority state legislature. Is there any sign GOP lawmakers might be willing to relent on this?
No, not at all. In fact, with the gubernatorial candidate, Doug Mastriano, he is a constitutional carry position that thinks that there should really be very little enforcement of gun laws in general. But there's been no swaying on letting Philadelphia create its own gun protection laws.
If Larry Krasner, DA Larry Krasner, were to be impeached and removed from office, say, do we know what happens next, or are the rules a little bit hazy?
The rules are a little bit hazy. There's only been two officials in the current, one during the current Constitution, which was Supreme Court Justice Rolf Larson, who was impeached through these means. The other person was a district judge in the early 1800s. So we know that Krasner wouldn't be able to hold office in Pennsylvania again. And I've been combing through the city charter trying to find out who has appointive powers, who can call a special election. I'm not sure.
That's a big job.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So just to wrap up, back to where we are right now in the process, remind us of what comes next.
What comes next is if Krasner continues to refuse to comply with the subpoena, the State House, now that they've held him in contempt, can now vote for legal enforcement of that. If he does participate, he can still hold out for the judge who he's petitioned, who perhaps might say that he's correct in his argument that this is an illegal view into his policies. But otherwise, the panel will move forward and their report will be issued in the forthcoming months.
Okay, so months to go.
Yes.
All right, Jordan Levy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jordan is general assignment reporter for Billy Penn. Up next on The Roundup, a new bilingual production premiering at People's Light Theater highlights undocumented farm workers in Kennett Square. We'll talk about with playwright Issa Davis. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Chances are the fresh mushrooms we pick up for dinner have been grown and harvested locally in what's been dubbed the mushroom capital of the world, Kennett Square, Chester County. And chances are most of us in our busyness aren't overly cognizant of the work done by those responsible for bringing this enormously popular edible type of fungus to the produce shelf, the families and communities who are the backbone of the mushroom industry, many of them immigrants and undocumented. Issa Davis has spent the last decade immersing herself in the culture of our local mushroom growing community as she developed her new play, Mushroom, now being staged at People's Light in Malvern. Davis was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for her earlier play, Bull Rusher, and has an extensive resume as a playwright and stage and screen actor. Mayor of Easttown fans remember her as therapist Gail Graham. Mm-hmm. Davis is also a composer and a singer and a pianist. Have I left anything out?
I don't think so at this point.
We are so pleased to welcome you, Issa Davis, to our studios here at WHYY to talk about your latest work.
Thank you.
So So to start, tell us a bit about your play Mushroom and some of the characters and the primary narratives.
Okay, well, you are catching me the day after our opening night, and I actually got to experience the people who I interviewed seeing their characters on stage last night, and that was just absolutely incredible, and it's really just one of the proudest moments that I've had in my life as a playwright. This play is just filled with these beautiful lives of people who are picking in the mushroom farms, people who are owners of the mushroom farms, other immigrants in Chester County. Of course, there's a large South Asian population there as well. So it's really designed to be a place where people can see these stories that they perhaps have never seen represented on stage or on screen, and feel that this voice, which is often, you know, by necessity because of being undocumented, silenced, right?
Yeah.
Actually making that very heard and also visible, you know? And that's actually, you know, the larger metaphor of mushrooms, right? Is that we have this huge mycelial network that's underground, that is feeding all of the plants and supporting all of us mammals who are eating those plants and the trees and our environment. And, you know, that mycelial network is a metaphor for all of the workers, the invisible labor that supports everything that we do,
yeah,
right, in this county, in this country, in this world. And so that level, that scope, is really what I tried to keep in mind, that it's this very local story that has all of these implications for us as humans.
That's great. How did you come to decide to explore the personal stories of those who are behind, under, supporting the mushroom industry?
Yeah. I couldn't tell you. It's been absolutely an unconscious form of magnetism. Where I first heard about the mushroom capital of the world, and that, you know, the majority of the mushrooms we eat are from Kennett Square and, you know, around there. And I don't know, I just was really drawn to it. Now, of course, I've spent a lot of time in Mexico traveling, and I'm from California, so there's a really strong sense of that being the Mexican culture is a home culture, you know. And I'm always really drawn to stories of working class people, which, again, I don't think we see enough of, you know, in their reality and in their granularity, you know, on stage and screen.
So when you spent years talking to folks in these communities, were they eager to tell their stories, or as immigrants and perhaps undocumented, a little guarded with you?
Actually, not at all. What I discovered was a huge sort of tsunami of wanting to tell a story, you know, wanting to tell these things that were quite intimate that they perhaps had never been able to share before.
Such
you know.
As what?
Oh, goodness. I mean, just to... For example, you know, how it is that you can try to get by without papers, right? So if you want to go to school, for example, and you don't have the papers that say you can, then all of the things that you have to do, you know, there are these notary publics who will find, you know, dead people's social security numbers or fake tax ID numbers. And this is all, again, toward doing something that actually will end up helping the entire society and polity as a whole. So someone that I spoke to, a beautiful woman who I met from the first time I came to Kennett Square, who worked at LCH, Health and Community Services there, she became a registered nurse, undocumented, and, of course, was one of the many essential workers who has been there taking care of all of us during this pandemic and, you know, taking care of everyone regardless of, you know, their status when they come into the hospital. And so I think that it's just to be able to hear what it is that people are doing in order to attain just – the things that we as citizens born here, you know, just take for granted, it's just been an incredible learning experience for me.
The development and writing of this play occurred to some extent during the Trump years, which saw severely restrictive immigration policies. How did this period in our nation's history influence your story?
It just made it more urgent, you know? And sadly, it's more timely now, you know? There are many people who come from Mexico to Chester County and to Kennett. And there are also now many more people coming from Guatemala, right? And there are refugees that come here, you know, and find it to be a safe place. You know, Kennett is a sanctuary city. But during the years of under 45, even though the area really had been more protected because everyone just sort of understood that it's agricultural. It's a place that if ICE did their job and raided all the farms, no one in the country would eat.
Yeah.
Right? So what we did was we really took that into the narrative of the play. So it's very much there, you know, what people experienced. You know, there weren't really any raids prior to 45. And then after that, under his administration, there were a lot of raids that really were designed to terrify the population, and immigration actually decreased under those years.
And this is reflected somewhat in
yes.
your play, Mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
You became particularly close, I understand, with a young woman, Anel Medina,
who is
a dreamer.
Yes.
How does the story of Anel and other dreamers fit into
well, she's that one, that nurse practitioner who has been, taking care of people in hospitals and also, you know, unofficially, right? Just she's just someone who has caring at the core of her nature, you know. And I think that's something I discovered throughout the area, is just this really strong ethos of care and volunteerism, you know. Some of the other people that I got to talk to and who shared their stories, an amazing stonemason named Luis Siguenza. And I mean, to learn about his history coming to New York, working at a pizzeria and then creating a pizzeria here and then working in the mushroom farms and then learning stonemasonry with Amish in the area and then starting his own business where he does construction of all kinds. I mean, it's a true American dream story, you know, and I don't even like that term American dream. It's, you know, riddled
an American story.
Right. Yeah. And a North American, a United Statesian story,
there you go.
I would say.
So what might a theater goer discover that is unexpected to them about this work in seeing the play?
That's a great question. What is unexpected, I think, is
most of us know very little about what folks do day in and day out to make sure this produce gets to the show.
Well, I think the main thing is that a lot of the protections we take for granted in workplaces, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that doesn't apply to agricultural, right? So the mushroom house conditions can be very difficult, where people are working really long hours, and, you know, the equipment and the actual beds where you're growing the mushrooms and the ladders, you know, that can just be old. It's a moist environment, so the wood is susceptible to rot, you know. So you're paid by the amount that you pick. So that just means that there's just a lot of, you know, chronic illness that develops.
Health insurance? No.
Right, there isn't any. So that's something that in a lot of ways, a place like LCH, which was formerly called La Comunidad Hispana, they kind of take up the slack, right? So they have been, from the very beginning, you know, founded by this woman, Margarita Quiñones, they've been kind of there as a health services and social services entity that when the folks on the farms don't have the protections and don't have the insurance that they need because they're independent contractors, they're not employees, right? They can come to LCH for that. So that's really something that I was really impressed by. And also, you know, just learning about the fact that the immigrant, there's no immigrant experience, right? Yeah. There are immigrant experiences. And, you know, I wanted to be able to compare a little bit of what it is to be sponsored by your company if you're a tech worker from India, for example. There's a character who's from Kerala and speaks Malayalam in the play. And what his experience is, you know, versus someone who is considered pretty much replaceable, right, or dispensable by their bosses.
Tell us about the characters. I'm trying to figure out a good way to phrase this, that you've most fallen in love with.
Oh, gosh. Favorite children.
Yeah.
Right. And that's actually a line in the play, like, I should have no favorites. But I'm the first thing that comes to mind, there's a character named Epifanio, and he's not based on anyone particular that I met, but just sort of things that I heard people tell me that had happened in their community, or someone that they knew, you know, sort of did this. Someone that I knew when I was growing up in California, they all sort of combined. It's a composite character. The reason why I love him is that he is so flawed. He does all of these things that end up really endangering the people he cares about the most.
Such as what?
Well, he feels in a lot of ways stripped of his dignity in this country. And he acts out in a lot of ways toward the women in his workplace, or the one woman in his workplace, you know, harassing her. He acts out in the sense that he has left his family behind in Mexico and Guanajuato, and he has a relationship with a woman, you know, that's very common, actually, amongst the men who have come to pick, is that, you know, there's also like a sex work industry that's kind of built up around that. Mm-hmm. So he's with one of those women, and then he does, you know, he kind of betrays his family. And the reason why I love him is because I understand him. And I think that's the thing that is so beautiful about plays, is that we actually can see people in all of their prismatic fullness that we don't necessarily get to see sometimes even in our own lives, that kind of compassionate 360 view can be there. And that's what I love doing as a playwright, is being able to see people for their whole selves, and also see communities from all of these different directions that perhaps our own limited perspectives can miss.
The dialogue in Mushroom is bilingual, but a theater goer does not have to be fluent in both languages or even know both languages.
That's right.
To understand.
Yeah, yeah. So Georgina Escobar, beautiful playwright in her own right, translated the play. She's Mexicana, and she really is the one that made this play what it is. Because if it were all in English, you know, and my bad Spanish, it wouldn't be able to land, you know, in the way that I saw it land in people's hearts last night. People were singing along, you know, to the songs that I sort of discovered along the way, that I thought maybe we should involve that here. She wrote a corrido that I had written in English, and she wrote it in Spanish, and everyone's trying to sing along because we have it set up as a little karaoke number. And, yeah, she's absolutely, you know, the reason why it speaks to the community that it was written for.
Yeah. A personal note, you are related to the famous activist Angela Davis.
That's right. In fact, I'm named after her. My first name's Angela.
Okay.
East is my middle name.
Your mom, did you want to separate that, by the way, just so, because Angela is Angela and you are Issa?
Well, no one ever called me Angela, I think, just because, you know, just to distinguish us.
Yeah. And your mom was also a civil rights attorney, I
understand? Yes, exactly. Yeah, she was a civil rights attorney for 30 years, really inspired by Angela's case and her being acquitted. And she actually is now a restorative justice practitioner. And that paradigm of restorative justice is very much in the play, Mushroom.
Oh, okay. So for yourself personally, I guess, is it fair to say that social justice work is in your blood?
I think we would have to say that. I think that we are a very...
I never want to make an assumption.
No, you shouldn't, but it's. I would say that, we're a family of warriors, and the way that I do it is different than the way that my mother does it and the way that my aunt does it, but to me, in your life, you are either for justice or you're against it, and that might even just mean that you don't care, right? And I would like to make things a little bit more equitable and more fair and just learn from where we have been, and also know that perhaps we may not get to that Platonic ideal of equality, but we can keep making it better.
Yeah. As I mentioned in the introduction, you are also a singer and a classically trained pianist, and, you know, you write and you act for the screen. Back to Favorite Children, and a playwright. I mean, is there anything you feel more favorably?
That's the thing, is that they all serve one another. Like, I have an introverted side and a side that I really love to build worlds, and that's the writer, you know. And then there's the performer side that, you know, I like to express myself in a bodily way. You know, that's really what I used to do growing up, and my mom and my aunt can tell you that. Like, I was always trying to get them to pay attention to my little living room shows.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but it was such a pleasure. Mushroom is at People's Light, through October 16th?
That's
right.
That's right.
Yes. Issa Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you coming by today.
Really,
Issa Davis is the playwright for Mushroom at People's Light. Up next, we speak with the librarian Martha Hickson. It is the 40th anniversary of Banned Books Week. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Banned Books Week was first launched 40 years ago this week during the Reagan era in response to an increase in challenges being made to books available in schools, libraries, and bookstores. Today, the dispute over content accessed by school children and youth not only continues, but it has, of course, intensified in school board meetings across the country, spilling over into school libraries and classrooms, often becoming ugly, leaving many librarians and teachers fearful in their work and frequently, quietly moving to pull contested books from library and classroom shelves. Martha Hickson has been working for years to fight the banning of books in public schools. Hickson is the librarian for North Hunterdon High School in New Jersey and the recipient of the 2022 Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians. Hickson is also a 2020 recipient of the American Association of School Librarians Intellectual Freedom Award. And she joins us for the rest of the hour on the Regional Roundup. Martha Hickson, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're glad you've decided to join us. Banned Books Week has been in existence since 1982. But Martha, you know, I don't have to tell you the past few years have been extremely tough for many librarians and teachers and other school personnel. What has changed in the 18 years since you began working as a school librarian?
Well, everything old is new again, as far as book banning is concerned. In the 18 years that I have been a school librarian, what has changed would be the methods, approaches, and tones. In the first several years of my work as a high school librarian, from time to time, there would be a parental concern about a book. I can think of a few examples: Looking for Alaska by John Green, Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, Where the Heart Is by Billy Letts. And in each of those cases, the parent contacted either the school principal or the classroom teacher to express concern about the work being read by their student. There then ensued a conversation where I could talk to the parent and hear what their concern was, give them a bit of background about the literary merit of the book and why it was in the library, and then remind them that the book was a choice for independent reading, and if that book wasn't a good fit, we have 20,000 others from which the student could choose. And that would solve the issue. What's happening now, though, is parents aren't having the conversation. They're bypassing that altogether, immediately heading to a board meeting for what can best be described as an outrage performance in order to get attention about these books.
Martha, did the conversation of 18 years ago contain the vitriol that we're seeing at school board meetings today?
Absolutely not. It would have been, at times it could have been an intense conversation because of the parent, depending on the degree of the parent's concern or the nature of the concern, but it never became a personal attack. It was always done with respect and out of sincere concern.
Remind us, Martha, which types of books are being targeted today?
Today, if you look at the statistics compiled by the American Library Association in the last year, the books that are primarily under scrutiny and target are those that are that feature people of color or have characters or themes related to the LGBTQIA community. In fact, there is some data from PEN America which analyzed those numbers. And if you collapse all of the various categories that PEN America identified that deal with either race or sex, gender, and sexuality, 80% of the targeted books last year dealt with one of those two categories.
So regarding school board meetings, not quite a year ago, you found yourself in the school board targeted by protesters who called you and some board members sex offenders who pushed pornography on students. At times, you've been labeled a pedophile and a groomer of children. How does such invective affect you personally?
It's very disturbing to even hear you repeat that now on the radio. And the board meeting at which that happened, we're almost at the one-year anniversary of it. It was September 28th, was recorded on video, and that's now been viewed more than 5,000 times on YouTube. As you can imagine, it is extremely distressing. I consider myself a professional. I have been considered a professional in my school building for the entire 18 years and have received nothing but uniformly glowing performance reviews. So to have my reputation damaged in that way, and even worse, to have an employer who has known me for 18 years not defend me in any way was traumatic. And
so
even talking about it now is hard.
The district didn't defend you?
No, that allegation hung over my head for 5 months. In January, the books were retained. There was still nothing said to defend me. And finally, between January and February, we launched a letter writing campaign to the board to say, you have a mess to clean up. And at the February board meeting, the board read a statement in which they declared those claims against me to be unfounded.
Martha Hickson, in an essay you wrote for the School Library Journal, you talk about the fact that your work nearly cost you your health. Tell us more about that.
There came a time about a month after that board meeting when it was kind of a perfect storm of crazy events happening. I was in my office responding at my principal's request to one of the pieces of hate mail that I began receiving from parents. While I was doing that, the board office sent me an Open Publics Record Act request for all of the financial records associated with the five books that were challenged, some of which had been on the shelves for years. So I was digging through that file in order to find that information. And some of our students who were very concerned about this situation entered my office at the same time asking for help in compiling a list of books that featured sexual situations that were not LGBTQ related. I counseled the students that whataboutism is not the way to handle this situation, but when they left my office, I felt extremely unwell. I had been to the nurse's office several times in the preceding weeks when I didn't feel quite right, and each time the nurse expressed concern about my elevated blood pressure, which is usually normal. But on this date, I went back to the nurse. She found my blood pressure to be about 165 over 95. I was hyperventilating. I was crying and unable to stop, and I couldn't even get out a full sentence. The nurse called my husband and had him pick me up and take me home. He took me to my personal physician, whom I've been seeing for 25 years, and she didn't recognize the person in her office as the person she knew. She pulled me out of work, referred me to a therapist, also found that I had the start of an ulcer, and she put me on anti-anxiety medication, which I continue to take to this day. I will say, thankfully, working with a therapist is the first time in my 62 years of life that I had ever done so. I wish I had engaged such services earlier, but I found that to be extremely valuable.
So if your health had been threatened, why continue in the fight against censorship?
Well, I'm looking out my office window right now, and I see the reason. I see these kids. You know, when the books are threatened, as much as I value and treasure the ideas in those books, at the end of the day, they are paper, ink, and glue. And as any librarian will tell you, eventually books leave the library for one reason or another. It's usually, you know, decades into their lifetime, but, you know, they stop being used, they're damaged, they're not in good condition. Books leave. We're used to that. But when I see a book under these circumstances, I see the reader. I know the kids who check out these books. And I cannot, in good conscience, just let the book leave, no questions asked, knowing that there's going to be a reader missing that information, a reader who needs that information, and a reader who may have no other way to get it than through the school library.
And again, Martha, you know, some of the material in some of the books in questions can have sexual content that some parents might disagree with. How do you respond to those parents who question whether such content is appropriate for access to students in a school setting?
I fully understand their concern regarding their own child, and that's a conversation between parent and child about what the expectations are, both with respect to behavior and reading. But that parent does not have the right to remove that material from every other child and every other family for use. Some of these materials aren't used just by the teen reader themselves, but by the entire family in order to have a conversation about this issue the family is facing. And another family does not have the right to take that out of their hands.
You told our producer, Paige, that some teachers on the other side of this issue shunned you. How do you deal with this when you have to work together?
Yeah, that was disturbing. I will say that over the course of the ensuing year, as more facts came to light and as my situation gained greater prominence due largely to that School Library Journal article, most of that active shunning has subsided. But all I can do in terms of dealing with it is to maintain my professionalism. I know that not every member of staff holds the same views regarding lots of issues, but we leave that outside of school and we treat each other as professionals while we're in the building, and we use our common bond of caring about the kids. So that's the way I've moved forward with that.
You've worked with the software company iRED to help develop an app called Demo Defense. What does it do?
Well, one of the things that we realize is that for Banned Books Week to be effective, for this problem to go away, is that people, not just librarians, but people out in the general public, need to report book banning when they see it. So working with a former high school librarian who was a former colleague, Arlen Kimmelman of IORAD, she retired from school librarianship and now works with IORAD, we collaborated across time and geography and space to create this little tool. And IORAD is great for doing quick technology demos. I actually use it in my teaching. So Demo Defense shows people, one, how to report challenges to the various organizations that collect this data and advocate on support of the First Amendment right to read. Those are organizations like the American Library Association, National Coalition Against Censorship, EveryLibrary.org, and so on. Furthermore, the demos show people how to donate to those organizations because those organizations are doing a lot of work and need the funds to do it. And if I can highlight one of those organizations in particular, it's EveryLibrary.org. They were by my side for 8 weeks providing strategic, tactical advice for dealing with my situation, and they are fantastic.
Martha Hixon, would you like to see school districts revise protocol regarding book challenges, and if so, how?
Yes. First, every school district needs to have a policy and a process for how they handle book challenges. I am fortunate in that my school district does. So some school districts don't. That's the first step, getting the policy and the process. And the American Library Association has templates available to do that. Or I invite you to look at the policy 2530 at North Hunterdon High School. It's available online. It is considered the gold standard for selection, and policy 9130 at North Hunterdon High School is the policy for public complaints and grievances. However, even in districts such as my own that have policies and processes in place, it is vital that those policies and processes be followed when a challenge occurs. PEN America found that in 98% of the challenges last year, there were violations of the best practices in terms of how to handle the challenge.
Such as?
So, well, there were ad hoc decisions made by library boards, boards of education, and school administrators. So rather than convening a reconsideration committee, which is considered best practice, those authorities in the district would make a decision on their own and not follow their process.
So you mentioned PEN America, which is a nonprofit organization. It's calling, I guess, this era the Ed Scare, shades of the 1950s.
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, I gave a presentation yesterday at, and this is a place everyone should look into as well, the Bayard Rustin Center for Social Justice in Princeton. And a portion of my presentation harkened back to that very era. My father happened to be in the audience at that presentation and recalled it well. Not only did we have Joe McCarthy accusing people of being communists, but back in 1954, people were very concerned about comic books, and there were attempts to pull comic books off the shelves.
In which ways? Do you remember?
Sure. There were great concerns that comic books were immoral, that they were promoting violence, and that they were encouraging young people to become juvenile delinquents. The concern was so great that the United States Senate held hearings about comic books. And in order to avoid government censorship of the works, the comic books industry created its own little censorship methodology. And in order to get the comic book seal of approval, publishers had to conform to 41 guidelines that included things like there could be no sex in the comic book, there could be no demonstration of disrespect for government or parental authority, and they couldn't even use slang or colloquialisms because there was concern that the jargon in comic books was causing young people to have poor English.
Fascinating stuff. We only have time for one more question, maybe 10 seconds worth here. You're approaching retirement, Martha. The anti-censorship work you do, as we know, can be grueling. Do you see yourself stepping back when you retire as a librarian?
My husband would love the answer to be yes, but I'm going to have a hard time letting it go. The good thing is, though, the kids are on top of this. Kids will keep fighting.
Martha Hixon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Martha Hixon is librarian for North Hunterdon Regional High School and the recipient of the 2022 Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians. Don't forget, you can find the regional roundup at whyy.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.